Fundación FAES en podcast.
Para mí es una gran satisfacción poder abrir este bloque internacional del campus FAES, un campus que anualmente refleja, yo creo que de manera particularmente fiel, lo que es la misión de esta fundación. Una misión que consiste en reflexionar, en activar ideas, en reunir talento y en contribuir desde posiciones fundadas al debate público. Quiero agradecer muy especialmente el trabajo de Mira Milosevic en la dirección de este área, en un campus que va a reunir, que reúne a un grupo de académicos, diplomáticos, periodistas de la máxima solvencia para tratar los temas que se proponen. La invasión de Ucrania ha vuelto a sacudir nuestras certezas. Yo creo que sabíamos que todo estaba cambiando, pero tal vez no queríamos reconocerlo en toda su dimensión. Lo cierto es que Putin nos vuelve a recordar que no debemos apartar la vista de las lecciones y de la experiencia histórica para analizar el presente y para situarnos ante el futuro. No sabemos ciertamente cuál será el desenlace de la guerra. En cualquier caso, sí sabemos que Europa y Estados Unidos son y serán determinantes para que Putin fracase. Y debo añadir que Putin debe fracasar. Y que por nuestra parte, nosotros como europeos, como occidentales, no debemos tener miedo de nuestro propio éxito frente a Putin. Algunos advierten de lo difícil que puede resultar tratar con una Rusia derrotada, pero es evidente que será mucho más difícil tratar con una Rusia victoriosa en su agresión. La invasión de Ucrania es evidente que ha creado nuevos problemas, pero sobre todo ha dejado al descubierto otros que se encontraban latentes, desde la energía a la definición estratégica europea, la relación transatlántica y el rumbo del proceso de construcción de la Unión Europea, pasando por la capacidad de resistencia y el músculo de nuestras democracias. Porque Putin no busca solo la anexión de una parte del territorio ucraniano, busca la destrucción de un pueblo, la verdadera, si se me permite la expresión, chechenización de Ucrania y el debilitamiento hasta la neutralización de la Unión Europea. Putin quiere hacer de Ucrania su nueva Chechenia y quiere la finlandización de la Unión Europea, una expresión, por cierto, que ya no puede utilizarse con el sentido que tradicionalmente ha tenido. Lo cierto es que esta confrontación tiene mucho de existencial para las democracias. No hay solamente una agresión por una ambición territorial, hay un designio político que Putin quiere hacer valer, y no solamente él. Por tanto, ¿cuál será el curso que seguirá la guerra? ¿Seremos capaces de resistir un invierno que Putin quiere convertir en su aliado para quebrar la determinación europea? ¿Habrá probabilidades reales de negociar una paz que no sacrifique a Ucrania? ¿Cuál será el futuro de las relaciones con Rusia? En fin, no pretendo, obviamente, ofrecer ninguna respuesta, pero sí insistir en que cuando hablamos de Rusia, de Ucrania y de lo que está ocurriendo a las puertas de Europa, hablamos también de España. Porque se trata de una realidad que nos afecta. Nos afecta no solamente como consumidores de energía, sino que nos afecta como ciudadanos libres. Y por eso este campus, con esta reflexión, aspira a ser algo más que un ejercicio teórico. Quiere ser modestamente un debate relevante en esta realidad compleja y amenazante ante la que tenemos que afrontar como españoles, como europeos y como demócratas. Now I would like to switch to English to welcome our guest speakers. I really thank you for your presence and your participation in this campus. We hold your expertise in high regard, Christopher, Ivan, and we really want to take advantage of your contribution to this campus. There is a lot of things I want to hear from you, and I'm sure there will be questions that you are in the best position to answer. As I said before, when we were talking formally, unfortunately, this is a very timely debate. And I say, unfortunately, you have to read the papers today, and you see the headlines, and we see the seismic effects of yesterday's Putin message, opening up the possibilities of the use of nuclear weapons and ordering a general mobilization in the country. Well, what we have to say at least is that so far it means that Putin's narrative is in tatters, that it has been shaken. This is not a special operation. This is a war aggression, and he has to acknowledge that. That is something politically very, very, very relevant. On the other hand, we are seeing the side effects, but very relevant, remarkable side effects of Putin decisions. Sweden and Finland membership of NATO. Denmark resigning from its opt-out in defense issues in the European Union, and the historic shift of Germany in its approach to their defense commitments. On top of that, we see that, I mean, Putin was very adamant yesterday, saying that he was not bluffing. That remains to be seen. Decision-making process to use a nuclear weapon is far more complex than it seems. It's not just Putin pressing the button, it is also true that the use of nuclear weapons would be a radical game changer, not only for the war in Ukraine. It will transform the strategic stage at global level. Finally, it's very hard to see how Putin would be able to retain the support that he has, given the latest reservations expressed by China and India, if he eventually makes the decision to use nuclear weapons and is able to execute that decision. And what about 300,000 more military staff, which has been called? Well, when you have a structural problems of your organization, if you add 300,000 people, then you're not making the situation better. Quite the contrary, you're making it worse. The structural weakness that we have seen, with a huge commitment of ground forces in Ukraine, with very little success, makes us, I would say, a bit skeptical about the ability of Putin to change the course of war by sending more troops. It doesn't mean that we have to take these threats lightly. It requires, they are demanding a strong and robust political response. But it's important that we keep in mind what I think is an important idea. We shouldn't be afraid of our own success against Putin. We shouldn't be afraid of our success against Putin when there are real chances of Putin failing in its criminal bet against Ukraine. So this would be my preliminary ideas for the discussion, and I am really delighted to give the floor to Ivan Voivoda. Ivan, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to FAIST. It's always a pleasure to come here, and thanks to Mira Milosevic, who's an old friend. And as you said, unfortunately, very, very timely. Let me say also by way of introduction that I have a very special relationship to Spain, a country that I love, because my late father fought in the Spanish Civil War as an international brigadier. And his love of Spain passed on to his children. And so we listened to many songs and, of course, then traveled. So it's also a very emotional thing to be here in Madrid with you all. Thank you for mentioning many of the things that are relevant to this discussion. As you said, Finland and Sweden would never have joined, I think, well, at least in the foreseeable future, because they kept this relationship to NATO. They were de facto part of NATO. I mean, Swedish troops participated, Finnish troops. So, you know, there was no particular added benefit to also be part of it because they were de facto members. And that is one of the things that the Russian wholesale invasion unprovoked created. So we live definitely in geopolitical times and geostrategic times, and we have been living for quite some time since basically after the two decades after the fall of the Berlin Wall, where there was hope that there would be convergence, not to mention the end of history, because for the country that I come from and that no longer exists, and Mira's country as well, Yugoslavia, there was no end of history. History continued, unfortunately, in the worst way possible with the breakdown of the country in a very violent fashion. So we have, in fact, had war in Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Terrible, with many victims, but not obviously on the scale of a nuclear power attacking a country of 44 million people. The country where we came from had 20 million people, and it was, to put it simply, an implosion that happened after the fall of communism. But when I say geopolitical times, I mean principally the rise of China, a G2 world that we're living in, the relationships between the US and China. And that's a big question for Europe. How does Europe position itself in this G2 world with a declining population, predicted to have 5% of the world population in the not so distant future? Obviously an economic powerhouse that Europe is. But then the series of crises that we went through, the economic crisis, the migration crisis, and then I would add to that the crisis of the election of someone called Donald Trump in America as a populist leader, to put it mildly, and then the first time a country member state of the EU left, Brexit. So all of this very tectonic events. But the Trump election really put Europe, had Europe put its finger to its head and ask, you know, what are we doing in terms of a possibility that the US retreats from its defense and security obligations to Europe. And we know the responses of Chancellor Merkel, of European leaders, that we had to think of times when we would have to act alone, which led to a variety of ways of thinking about strategic autonomy, the creation of the sort of defense unity of Europe. PESCO, some would say, is a feeble beginning of that. I would not say that. I think it's an important beginning where European countries come together in a variety of defense initiatives. And some analysts have said that, in fact, there were two big mistakes. With hindsight, of course, we're all very very clear about things, that two things really were a mistake. One is the over-reliance on the United States for the security of Europe, and the second one was, of course, the over-reliance of Russia on energy and gas in Europe. And what will it take to roll back that and create a bigger balance in Europe? Some have predicted that it would take Europe 25 years to have its own full defense and security. The question is, do we need it or not? We can debate this later. But what has clearly happened with the Russian invasion is that Europe is going to wean itself off completely off Russian fossil fuels. That is extremely clear. That is a big mistake. And you said, you know, Putin's illusions about what would happen. About that, there is no question that Europe will not go back there, whatever the future relations with Russia will be. And of course, Russia will not fall off the map. It will be there, so some kind of relations would need to happen. But if I go back, I would say, for me personally, it was the Putin speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007 that was the rhetorical equivalent, again, I say for me personally, to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. For me, that was really an eye-opener. I said, things have completely changed now. The way that he laid out his vision of relations with the world, with Europe, with NATO, I mean, it was completely something unexpected, just as the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine was. And if you follow from there, the invasion of Georgia in 2008, the invasion of Ukraine in 2014, let's not forget that that war started 8 years ago, not on February 24th, that there were 7,000 people killed in that period between 2014. And so the intention, the imperialist intention of Ukraine, and of course his famous July historical article about how Ukraine is not Ukraine and this is all, we're all one people. You know, he spent his 2 years of COVID locked up and studied quote unquote history and came up with this article, which I recommend you read if you haven't, because there he lays out this imperialist vision that they need to retake the historical lands, as he says, of Russia and Novorossiya. As well. And so we have been seeing this, and what, again, with hindsight, one needs to ask one question. So 2007 speech, invasion of Georgia 2008, and invasion of annexation of Crimea and part of the Donbas in 2014. And then you look at the energy situation. Nord Stream 1 was finished in 2011, so well after the invasion of Georgia, well after the speech in Munich. And then, of course, Nord Stream 2 was finished recently. Then there's a big contract with Gazprom in 2017. And that, I would say, is normal behavior for those of us who are rational people. And, you know, one need not, but it's always nice to quote the great French philosopher Charles de Montesquieu, that talked about les doux effets du commerce, the soothing effects of commerce. So if we trade, if we are interlinked, then there is no reason for us to be in conflict. And again, I say that is in I think our world, a normal thing. Turns out, unfortunately, that this becomes the nefarious effects of commerce. We're too interlinked, and one actor decides to actually start behaving in our world irrationally, rational from his or their point of view in Russia because they feel endangered. There's this sense that NATO is encircling them. You know the whole argument. And again, the speech of Putin yesterday or the day before was that they are in a war with the West, that the West wants to destroy them, and they have to defend themselves. So they're suddenly the victims of all of this. They're not Ukraine. That Ukraine is just a kind of a pawn in the game in this big conflict with the West. And obviously, needless to say, all his intelligence predictions were wrong. You know, the capturing of Kiev, regime change in 2 days, and removing Zelensky from power, which was talked about in the days before, that, you know, basically Zelensky doesn't have a chance. He'll be wiped away from the blackboard of history like that in one sweep. So completely erroneous predictions on their part, and that talks, I would say, to the corruption in the Russian intelligence services, in the military, and the like. There's a quote that apparently Talleyrand mentioned, that Russia is dangerous both when it is too strong and when it is too weak. Omnipotent and impotent at the same time. And I think we're seeing some of that. Strong because it has a nuclear weapon. And you rightly mentioned the danger that exists. You know, we cannot rule out anything at this moment. Probably not a full nuclear strike, but a tactical nuclear strike. I mean, just as bad. And then the question is, how does Europe and how does the West respond? The other thing that Putin underestimated is the resilience of Europe and the unity and solidarity of Europe, with all the kind of cracks here and there in the system. And here, since we're talking about Europe after the Russian invasion, I need to focus on Europe for a second. And someone will remind me if I'm going on for too long. And that is the issue of the internal democratic dynamic in Europe. And I'll be completely simple and open. The fact that we have democratic backsliding in Hungary and Poland in various ways, and these countries are not the same, and we can discuss the differences. But the fact that Europe has been slow, as it usually is, in tackling this issue that a member state is curtailing the rights and freedoms and the rule of law of the judiciary, of the academia, kicking out a university in Europe. I mean, just you know, focus on that for a moment, the Central European University that is now removed and is in Vienna, where I currently am. All of these things, there was kind of wishful thinking, okay, maybe he'll lose the next election and, you know, we'll not have to deal with it. We have elections in Poland, so it will be very interesting to see with it. Europe, as usual, muddles through, awakens, and starts acting, and that is what we're seeing with the Article 7 that was invoked on the question of Poland and Hungary, and now, of course, with the withholding of the recovery funds, or at least a significant part of them, to Hungary. Interestingly, I think one needs to mention that we have these processes in Poland and Hungary, but the capital cities are in the hands of the liberal democratic opposition, both in Warsaw with Mayor Trzaskowski and Budapest, that is under the lead of Mayor Karaczony. So the picture is missed, and we mustn't draw black and white pictures on these countries. But if Europe is to be the model and the showcase for other countries of an international rule-based order based on domestic democratic politics, then it has to pursue this policy of trying to right the wrong of having a country such as Hungary, which is the more egregious case, and it is doing something about it. And this brings me to the issue of Ukraine and Russia. I think, first of all, we must keep reminding ourselves that Russia is back to being a totalitarian country. There is no free media to speak of. All the non-governmental organizations have been shut down. You raise a white piece of paper in a street in Moscow and you are put to jail for 10 to 15 years. We saw the reaction in a number of towns yesterday where people came out into the streets and protested against the mobilization. So there is a sizable, people say about 10% of the population who are fully and vocally against the war. But I think what the fear of Putin was not only what he sees as the encirclement of NATO, but was to have a democratic country, however weak, however feeble as the Ukrainian democracy was, and we know it, as a model that could influence political dynamics in Russia. And let's not forget the assassination of Boris Nemtsov close to the Kremlin, the poisoning of Navalny as the key oppositional figure are all models. And in fact, our friend and colleague Ivan Krastev many years ago already spoke, and I think this is very important and leads to the Munich speech in 2007. Ivan Krastev said that the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004 was Putin's 9/11. That was for him the thing that shook him. That, believe it or not, people can change the power in the street if they don't like an autocratic ruler. And there are so many books about, if you go back to the analyses of our colleagues in various think tanks and others, of what was the Orange Revolution, it was the choice for Europe and democracy. And Ukraine moved on that path very slowly, but still moved rightly. And why did the Maidan happen in 2014, which Putin and Lavrov call a coup d'etat? No, it's very simple. Because Ukraine was moving towards the European Union, Yanukovych, the then president, refused to sign the Deep and Comprehensive Trade Agreement, the DCFTA. What did that mean? That meant for the Ukrainian people in Kiev at the Maidan that, okay, we're moving slowly, a millimeter a day, but we're moving towards Europe. Yeah, we know our country has a difficult history, but at least the path is straight. The moment that Yanukovych broke that path and people realized we're not moving to the European Union, that you had the popular explosion. You had basically Orange Revolution 2.0. And that, again, was a reminder to Putin that no, Ukraine will not fall under some kind of autocratic Yanukovych oligarchic influence, but they will keep moving, however slowly. And for him, as many have said, and I say, Ukraine would have been a sort of West Berlin behind the wall as a model to the East Berliners of what life can be. And I think that defines also the nervousness of Putin, the kind of trigger-happy Putin that decided to invade the country. How much more do I have, Mira?
Maybe 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes.
Just to have time.
I will leave the issue of the enlargement to the side. But I will say this, European Commission under the leadership of the former German Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen declared itself a geopolitical commission. And we in the Western Balkans, from where I come from, saw this very positively because of the influence of Russia and China in our region. And there again, the European Union was slow to awaken to this fact. It did awaken last year. For example, Ursula von der Leyen came to Belgrade and there was a geo-economic investment. And I would like to stress very clearly that I think Europe needs to do much more on the geo-economic front. For example, in our region, I leave Ukraine to the side for a moment. And because geo-economics is geopolitics, and this is a way to show the importance that Europe gives to the geographical area where it operates. I mean, you all know that Ukraine needs about 5 billion euros a month to survive, 60 billion a year. So that harks a whole issue about, you know, what can be done about that, and that's just for Ukraine to keep living. The idea of a European political community, I think, is extremely important. As you know, there will be a meeting in Prague on October 6th, in basically 2 weeks' time, where European leaders, you know, Macron's idea, but Charles Michel as well, an idea that Mitterrand had, by the way, some 30 years ago, to serve as a midway step towards membership. I will just say one thing, that if the European political community is to have any sense and substance, it must not turn out like the European Union for the Mediterranean, which is basically a series of meetings and talk shops, to be unpolite, with not much happening. It needs to be seen as a step on the path to EU enlargement. And yes, we all know that EU enlargement will take time, but it needs to happen in a way that the countries feel that are getting closer to the table or sitting at the table for a certain number of issues. And we can talk about that more in the enlargement time. This weakness of Russia, we see, has provoked the recent conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan again, between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, which is really off our media map. You have to really dig to try and find out what this is all about. But everybody senses that there is a weakness and that Russia cannot act everywhere at the same time. Finally, what should Europe do? Well, very simply, preserve the unity and solidarity among itself and towards Ukraine. We have elections in Italy, as you know, in 2 days' time. We'll see how that pans out. Everybody says that Giorgia Meloni will lead a government with a party that has fascist roots, interesting in itself. We have to fight the disinformation. Russia is using all sorts of ways. Again, I'm sure you've talked about that at FIES. There needs to be a much greater effort to fight the fake news and to put forward the various complex elements about what is in play. Last but not least, social issues and inequality. I mean, that's the much broader, I would say, global issue where people feel disaffected because they are not being catered to. And that means that this winter, the way that we go through this winter, whether we survive it, will there be protests in the capital cities of Europe? Everybody is trying to find ways in which to accommodate people. In Austria, for example, we will all get 500 euros to try and compensate for the rising prices of energy, and other countries are doing that. The final kind of thought is going back to someone called Niccolò Machiavelli, who had this distinction between fortuna and virtù. Fortuna is basically destiny. We're being carried by the winds of the world. And opposed to that is virtue or capacity. And Machiavelli says basically that if we are, you know, aware enough, conscious enough, solidary enough, courageous enough, then our capacity can maybe shift the winds of destiny. And that is why I say that the need for solidarity and the understanding that you need to be bold and courageous and make decisions like, you know, making Ukraine a candidate for the European Union are, we know, symbolic but very important, but they need to be followed up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ivan. There's so much food for thought that you have provided that we would have keep listening to you for far more than it has been said. And now I think it's Mira who's taken over. lead of the conversation.
Good morning for everybody. Now is my turn. Thanks again to Ivan Vejvoda for coming to FAES. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And as Javier said, you give us a lot of food for thoughts. You have already known Javier, of course, who is director of FAES Foundation, Ivan Vejvoda, but I would like also to introduce Christoph Wolfram, who is second secretary of the German embassy in Madrid. We are talking about a lot about Germany in last weeks in Europe, in Madrid. And when FAES applied for support of Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Spanish government for this campus, which is a kind of tradition already, Hablamos de Europa, we are talking on Europe every year. The war in Ukraine have been intensifying, but the news of the new general mobilization, partial, of Russia is really a new step in this conflict. So it's really inevitable to talk about Ukraine, but we have also to talk about Europe. We are talking about Ukraine and the same time when we talk about the Europe. So it's clear that the Russian invasion has given a new reason to exist for the Atlantic Alliance, that the Russian invasion also strengthened the transatlantic relationship and accelerated the birth of geopolitical Europe. But we have been talking about it even in last year, about Russia, about relationship between the European Union and Russia, about Ukraine. But I think that the last discourse, the last speech of the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, really deserved more comments. And for that, I would like to ask Javier, who is also a member of European Parliament. I would ask him to comment what would you highlight in particular from the speech of the President of the European Commission, and please, if you can, focus on especially what exactly does mean that we have to talk about the future, but we must act in the present. How we can do that? I like these very, very catchy sentences, but sometimes I don't understand how to do that. So I'm here to ask uncomfortable questions. Or not so uncomfortable.
No, we will see. Well, the first thing I have to say is that von der Leyen's speech lived up to the expectations, and the expectations were very high. The setting of the speech was also a message in itself. As you know, the President Zelensky's wife attended the speech. And not as an expected part of the audience, but there, just beside the rostrum. So it was in itself a very strong message. First of all, I would say that now in the European Union there is a sort of inward-looking habit about what has gone wrong and what we got wrong in our relations with Russia. And Ursula von der Leyen reflected that, saying we got it wrong, we were too naive, we should have listened our Baltic partners, and we should have taken more seriously their concerns. Well, having said that, what are the conclusions or the consequences that we draw from that assertion that I think we all can share? She was very strong in rejecting any kind of appeasement policies, vis-à-vis Putin, no appeasement. He reminded while we Europeans calculate the cost of war in terms of euros, Ukrainians calculate the cost of war in terms of lives. It was quite strong statement, but she made two commitments that were very, very remarkable. One is the open and full access of Ukraine to the single market. Ivan has just recalled the very root causes of Maidan uprising. Well, Ukraine will have full access to the single market, and she reasserted the so-called European perspective of Ukraine, which is linked to some extent to this European political community, but not entirely linked to this European. I think that Ukraine will have a specific path towards towards enlargement. Of course, the military support is reassured. And all in all, it was a very robust statement in the current situation that I'm sure that was very well received by Ukraine, and was supported by almost all groups in the parliament. The main issue regarding Ukraine in the European Union is how to preserve the internal, not unity, but cohesion. We all condemn Russia's aggression, but we have to turn that into specific, well-thought, operational political decisions. I do think that Ursula von der Leyen's speech was a major contribution to this purpose, and also I think that Putin is proving to be a major factor of cohesion within the European Union, even if he wouldn't like that. I don't see, not in those countries who are still more dependent, or even more, let's say, understanding of Russia's reasons or non-reasons to invade Ukraine, I don't see that they wouldn't keep in line with the European Union. I think that the political cost would be immense, the reputational cost would be immense, but also it would all depend on the kind of leadership that the European institutions can provide. Political leadership, bearing in mind what we have ahead of us, will be a crucial factor in keeping the not only the internal cohesion, but also the effectiveness of European Union action with regard to Ukraine.
Thank you, Javier. Thanks again, Christoph, for being today with us. It is clear that one of the consequences of the war in Ukraine is the transformation of Germany. The German Chancellor himself, Mr. Schulz, has spoken of Zeitenwende, of a turning point for Germany and for Europe. Germany is supporting Ukraine, it is sending heavy weapons, it is going to increase defense spending, and it is changing its economic model because have to dispense the cheap Russian energy. So what is happening in Germany? Because we all of us, we know that destiny of Germany during the history has marked very, very heavy the destiny of Europe and all post-Cold War international order also was marked by reunification of Germany and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which even mentioned. And now we are in the kind of turning point. Now, what is this transformation mean for Germany, for Europe? You can take a little bit more time because you didn't said anything until now. So please explain us. And thank you again to be here with us.
Thank you very much, Mira, and thank you very much for inviting me to this incredibly interesting panel. I must say, until now, it's really illuminating for me to sit here and listen to you and hear all what you have said. And many of the things that you have said, of course, refer also a lot to Germany. So. When we talk about a turning point in Germany, I think the first thing for me to stress is that it's not only a turning point for Germany, but it's rather a turning point for the whole of Europe and maybe even for the entire international community, but especially for Europe, because I think that if you want to put it in a nutshell, we can say that that definitely as of the 24th of February, maybe the development has even started before, but as of the 24th of February, we all can be for sure that we move on from a environment of cooperative security in Europe to an environment of confrontative security, which is a basic shift in how we deal with our security policy as such. I think this is the basic point from which all other turning points and transformations stem and can be developed. With historical turning points, it's always, or very often, it's that you recognize them as being historical, but you don't realize all at once what they entail and what are all the consequences and what are the different consequences of these turning points. And I think. It's fair to say that also in this turning point, we all have a very, very strong feeling that it's very historical, but we cannot tell what will change through the midterm. But I think that there are, in the case of Germany, there are some elements which we already see, and we have to see, and we have to take into account for the agenda. And I will concentrate on three elements in my response to your question. First, the defense sector, defense field. Second, the energy field. And third, the field of European policy in Germany. When it comes to the defense field, the first to say is that what has really dramatically changed is the posture of Germany when it comes to military aid. I think this is a huge landmark change in German policy, which doesn't have anything to do with what kind of government was in power before. The question of not sending military aid into areas of conflict was a policy which was absolutely consensual in Germany. And this has changed. We support Ukraine as being the attacked in this horrible conflict. We support it in economic, financial, political, humanitarian, but also in military matters. This is a really a full change of course for German policy, and we will continue to support Ukraine also in the coming weeks and months. Ukraine will again receive new state-of-the-art weapons from Germany, such as air defense, radar systems, or reconnaissance drones. Our latest arms package alone is valued at over 600 million euro. And our goal as such is there to be a modern Ukrainian armed forces that really can permanently defend their country. So I think this is worth mentioning as the first point in what has really changed in the German security posture. But that's not the only thing in defense. You already mentioned the special fund for our own armed forces of 100 billion for better equipping and modernizing our Bundeswehr. The administration is now in the process of identifying where best to put that money. Chancellor Scholz, in his speech in Prague a couple of weeks ago, already mentioned the plan to heavily invest into air defense in Germany, always, of course, with a view to being interoperative with allies in that regard. This also has a lot of additional effects, question of procurement in military affairs has to be simplified to make things faster and increase the ability to really improve our possibilities to defend ourselves. So I think that defense sector is the first big chunk where I would really say that there we have a turning point. Even if we also, I mean, you have mentioned Munich Security Conference. Since the 2007 speech, there was a huge discussion already taking place in Germany on how can we move on, how can we really take more responsibility as Germany in defense matters. I think it's even called the Munich consensus or the Munich spirit. I can't remember exactly how the concept was. Second, energy. It was already widely mentioned here. Of course, this is the second huge turning point. It is clear that our dependency on Russian fuel, fossil fuels, has to be ended. We have to finish that. Russia uses Europe's energy dependence as a for their strategic purposes. And they use it especially also to break the inter-European solidarity and the unity amongst Europeans, as well as the solidarity with Ukraine. So we cannot do other things than to oppose that. So the plan or the strategic choice for Germany is to completely end our dependency on Russia, which, by the way, means that the Nord Stream 2 approval process, which has been halted, will not be taken on again. So Nord Stream 2 will be continuously off the table. And we're doing everything to as rapidly as possible reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. We are already come some way with regard to petroleum and coal, but also with gas. The German dependency, which was at the beginning of the conflict at 55% of our gas consumption, is now at 26% since the beginning of the year. So there is a significant reduction, but it requires for us, for our economy, for our energy policy, huge effort, we have to find a bundle of measures to get there. If you want to resume them, I would say it's three basic lines of action. It's energy savings, more energy efficiency, and a faster buildup of renewable energies. The government has in April adopted a legislative package, the so-called Eastern Package, for acceleration of build-up of renewable energies, with a whole bunch of laws on aeolians, solar, on renewable energies as a whole. The procedures have to be fastened up in order to get to 80% electricity from renewable energies until 2030, which is, I think, quite ambitious, but one has to be ambitious in these days. So, of course, in this energy field, it's not just Germany; it's an issue for the whole of Europe. And I think the Commission, we've heard it already, they have made a lot of substantial proposals, and there's a lot of also cohesion and solidarity amongst member states in order to reach these goals. Because Germany is, of course, heavily dependent on Russian fossil fuels, but Germany is not the only member state who's very dependent on that. A third, I've already touched upon Europe. Maybe it's not as sharp a turning point, because Germany was always very supportive of the European Union, and Germany was always taking the European Union as the fundamental framework for its relationships with its neighbors, and this of course remains like that. There's no doubt about that. But I think, as we've seen in the speech from Chancellor Scholz in Prague a couple of weeks ago, we also have the feeling that this point in time is a point in time to get back to see where are we with the European Union, what does this historical moment mean for the further development of the European Union, and maybe do we have to give it another thought on really making the European Union our player of choice in this whole geopolitical conflict situation. The Chancellor has talked about four strands: the strand of enlargement, and together with internal reform. And I say it with a view to Ivan, not internal reform, not as a precondition for enlargement, but as a precondition for the EU being able to function with a lot more member states. And I might add, also without enlargement, we would need this kind of reforms. Mm-hmm. When it comes to decision making, when it comes to especially the question, how can we avoid that the veto of very few member states, or one single member state in many cases, hampers the EU as a whole? You talked about the European Union being very slowly. I think one of the reasons, not the only, but one of the reasons, is also in some of the areas, at least, the question of unanimity, which still is there, especially in foreign policy. The second field is the question of a strategic sovereign European Union that refers to many fields. I just want to pick out the part of a robust European resilient economy. There's the question of dependency, not only in energy, but also in many other cases, where we really have to give it another thought on how can we guarantee, on the one hand, our open economy, which is, I think, at the heart of Europe, but at the same time avoid dependencies in strategic goods and technologies that we need. The semiconductors is just a point in case, but it's definitely not the only one. The third strand to which you referred was the question of cohesion as such. We have to overcome in the European Union the traditional division lines that we have, for instance, in the migration field, also in the field of economic governance of the European Union. I think this is another effort we have to do, because if we don't avoid these internal divisions, it will be very difficult to be a very powerful actor to the outside as well. And the third part, we also referred to it before, is the question of our own values, of our democratic situation inside the European Union. You said that the European Union acted very slow. That's probably true. I've been dealing with the rule of law issues in the European Union since 2012, so that's already 10 years, and the issue is going on since then. On the other hand, one has to acknowledge as well that in the beginning of the European Union, we parted from the fiction, maybe, that all these values were completely uncontested inside the European Union. And so this has something to do with what are the competences of the European Union in this field. In the meantime, the European Union and the jurisdiction, they have evolved, of course, and probably they will evolve even more, because also we as Germans are, at least we as Germans as well, are of the opinion that we have to deepen our cooperation in order to foster and enhance our value basis. Maybe I leave it at that for the moment. I don't know whether I've talked enough.
Encouraged
me to talk
that
longer.
Is enough.
Is enough. Good.
That is enough for now. Because Ivan promised me to talk more about the enlargement, and I would like to back to this very important question. Last week I met some French senators and we talked about enlargement, and after our meeting I remember Duško Radović. I think that only Ivan Vejvoda know who is he. He was one poet from Serbia, and he, when I finished the meeting with French senators, I remember a joke of Duško Radović, which is more or less, if you finish your studies, you don't have job, you can get a marriage. If your marriage is bad, you can have children. You always can solve a small problem with the bigger one. So more or less the French position about enlargement, I can resume that the enlargement is a way to solve a small problem with a bigger one. This is like because they have a lot of doubts about if the European Union can do that. I think that one of the consequences of these doubts is this proposal of the political community, and I agree completely with Ivan when he said it is the European Union for the Mediterranean countries or for the Balkan countries only. So Ursula von der Leyen also said that the European integration had begun in peacetime, but now it must continue in the context of the war. How can this be done, and what does it mean exactly? It's like keep calm and carry on. It's to solve the small problem with the bigger one, please make maybe difference between the enlargement of the Western Balkans countries and this express status of candidates for Ukraine, Moldavia, and this in-between states between the European Union and Russia. I will back to Javier and Christoph with this question about the political community. We have a lot of questions, but I think that really the enlargement is one question which is a huge question about the credibility of the European Union and all these things what you have mentioned. So please, Ivan, start. The floor is yours.
All very easy questions.
Of course.
One thing I will say before addressing this, which we didn't mention, but it's clear to all of us, the invasion of Russia on Ukraine has created the biggest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. 6 million people on the move, and we basically don't talk about it for good reasons, because these people have been accepted in enormous numbers in the countries that border Ukraine. Poland, of course, Baltic countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Moldova, all of them have hugely high percentages related to their population. I think that's something we need to reflect on as well. If it continues, if the war continues, if more people leave, this will be also an issue in our policy. Okay, enlargement, my favorite theme. Well, first of all, I will repeat that it was very important for the European Union, and Javier really gave the spirit of von der Leyen's speech, which was very important for Europe to finally step out, go the extra mile, and give candidacy to Ukraine and Moldova, and potentially to Georgia, if Georgia meets a certain number of prerequisites. Let me start from maybe an unusual point. As far as my country, Serbia, is concerned, after the fall of Milosevic, we were told, and I was the advisor to the Prime Minister then, Zoran Djindjic, we were told in no uncertain terms, the European Union will not ever take in a country with unresolved territorial issue like it did with Cyprus. So Cyprus was a one-off, an exception, no need to go into that history, but the European Union will not do that. Why do I say this? First of all, because my country has an unresolved territorial issue with Kosovo, and my president, Vucic, gave a speech at the United Nations, and all the titles in the newspapers this morning in Serbia are his sentence: what is the difference between territorial integrity of Ukraine and the territorial integrity of Serbia? Okay, I'll leave that for lunch discussion. Why do I say that again? Because all three of these countries, Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, have unresolved territorial issues. Russia has put the foot in the door. In Georgia, it's Abkhazia and South Ossetia. In Moldova, it's Transnistria. In Ukraine, of course, it's the Donbas and Crimea. So, and numerous leaders have all said, whether it's Macron or Scholz and von der Leyen, this will take a long time for them to join. I would love us all to join. And to your question on the difference, Mira, I think I see this as one issue for Europe. Europe's most successful policy has been enlargement. Economically, politically, it shows the strength of Europe. And we must not separate these two, however much we may want to separate them, because these are post-Soviet territories. The Western Balkans is not post-Soviet. It is, we know that Yugoslavia was this independent socialist communist country, and of course Albania is now in the same package. So there are differences, but we in the Western Balkans, I've heard many colleagues say, now we are in the same family, and we need to address this together, whatever the differences may be. There was a complacency, like in many other places, so there was complacency on the enlargement. Okay, they did war, they're not fighting anymore, there are issues in rule of law, governance, corruption, etc. Yes, there were these issues as well when Bulgaria and Romania joined in 2007, and they were taken in, and I think, again, this was a geopolitical enlargement. Just imagine today, Romania and Bulgaria, not members of NATO and not members of the European Union, completely open to a possible Russian invasion into the heart of Europe. So at times you need to make courageous, bold decisions to take in countries that are not yet ready, to put it that simply. And I have to say, once again, both as a French student and a Francophile, that France did a big disservice to enlargement in 2019 when it blocked Macedonia and Albania after a historic, I repeat, historic compromise between Greece and North Macedonia over a territorial or a name issue, not a territorial issue, a name issue, about the name of the country, North Macedonia. And the two statesmen, Tsipras and Zaev, prime ministers of those two countries, went against the public opinions of their countries that were against the deal. Greece had been blocking North Macedonia for 27 years. Very European behavior on the part of a country that we all love, Greece, and where we have many friends. But Tsipras found the statesman courage to say, okay, people, we need to move on and resolve this issue. And they did. The Prespa agreement, North Macedonia decided to change its name. So I'm not Ivan, but Mirko tomorrow, right? It's not an easy thing to do. And what happens then, instead of, and I give you the atmosphere in the region was really that there was a momentum. We were taking off. Macedonia would now move more quickly to accession because they had done some reforms, and Albania had done quite a lot on the rule of law, and Germany in particular recognized the advance that Albania had done. And there was a pressure in Serbia on the government, okay, they have resolved the hard issue, now we are in line because we need to solve Serbia and Kosovo. And so there was really this sense, okay, finally it's moving again. What happens? France pours a cold shower over the whole thing and says, no, first we must do internal reform and then we will enlarge. And for all of us, this was a huge deception. And, you know, it went from bad to worse because that opened the door to a European member state called Bulgaria to start bringing in issues of history, language, ethnicity, and all that. I spare you the details on that. But I just give you, you know, that however we believe in Europe, and God knows we believe in Europe and what it stands for, Europe makes mistakes, or certain member states at certain times make mistakes. And okay, that has been now rectified. There is this compromise, I won't go into detail, between Bulgaria and North Macedonia, and they're finally moving. So that's a positive thing. What I want to say very briefly, because there's too much other things to say, is that what we need now is, and that is why it is important what Chancellor Scholz said in his speech, what President of the Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said, these countries belong in the European Union and we need to do everything to get them in. I repeat very emphatically and strongly, the homework is on our side. We need to do democratic reforms in our countries, improve governance, rule of law, and anti-corruption. There's no doubt about that. But this movement to Europe does not help happen without the helping hand of our friends in Brussels and in the member states, which are key. And so the renewal of what is called the Berlin process that Chancellor Merkel started in 2014, that Chancellor Scholz will now have a meeting in Berlin on November 3rd, where all countries will be brought to give additional impetus along with what Brussels is doing. And what many of us and many of our think tank friends have been doing is thinking of ways how we can move closer, so it's not a black and white, you're not a member and then you're a member, and in between nothing happens. The big thing that happened, we got visa-free travel. By the way, Kosovo does not have it yet. Ukraine has visa-free travel. Moldova has visa-free travel. Why doesn't Kosovo have it? Hopefully it will happen. So our goal is, let's have us at the table on security, on disinformation campaigns, on the Green Deal, you know, how do we have these countries without voting rights, without veto rights or anything, but to feel part of the family, because there's a sense, there's a fatigue, of course, in Europe with enlargement. There's what my friend Remzi Lani from Albania says, that, you know, we went from repression in communism to depression now because Europe is not taking us in. And I think we need to overcome that, because even the most fervent Europhiles in our countries are losing faith and saying, basically, okay, this is all, they're pretending to enlarge us and we're pretending to reform. No, we need to overcome that. And I think a positive move, for example, the European Stability Initiative saying, let's take in Montenegro by 2028. A small country of 600,000, it would be a nice thing. I'm positively for it. Whether it happens or not, that's a whole other issue. But more focus, and more tender love and care, as the expression goes, would be very helpful.
Thank you very much. Ivan, we have 10 minutes more. Ivan gave us a very complete answer for this question. So, Javier, please, like, you have 5 minutes if you like to talk about the political community, the proposal of Macron about the enlargement, about, or if you like to comment anything else regarding what we have been talking. You have 5 minutes.
Well, as far as the political community is concerned, it was just mentioned in von der Leyen's speech, but I'm sure that the French will have a very brilliant presentation of their idea, but then we will have to see how we can land it. So it remains a big question mark with the expectations, because I'm sure that the French have thought out what they want to propose. But I'm not an expert in Western Balkans, but I do see that there is a real interest on them. It's out of question that enlargement is somehow a founding mission of the European Union. At the European Union, its success has been precisely to act as a crucial stabilizer of Europe in the various processes, political processes that Europe has followed, the authoritarian regimes in Southern Europe, Spain among others, those who came out of the fall of communism, and now we have Western Balkans. As I said, I'm not an expert on that, but I've always remembered what Cecily Mira told me, quoting Churchill: the problem with the Balkans is they consume far more history than they produce. So what we have to try is to make Balkans to produce history, start to produce history. The standard, the gold standard to measure the success of the Balkans can no longer be the fact that they don't go to war with each other every certain period of time. That is not enough. On the other hand, we know that there are specific problems. Bosnia and Herzegovina has serious constitutional problem now. Montenegro, even Serbia, have a worrying exposure to disinformation, penetration of China, the role that the Orthodox Church is playing. Organized crime. We all know that. Obviously, we cannot wait until all these problems are solved, because the European Union must be a vital factor in the solution of these problems. I think we have to engage more with civil society. I do think that there is a civil society wishing to overcome problems of the past. We need to be far more active in this information, which means to be able to build an attractive and convincing narrative. And what Ivan has told is essential. We need to make the process credible. Not even the outcome, but we have to make a process credible. The important thing is the process, and there are a lot of things that we can do, not only to attract public opinion in Western Balkans to the European cause, but also to bring about real changes on the ground and in the daily lives of people. Be aware of the dimension of the problem. I think that the Balkans, Western Balkans, represent no more than 1% of the European GDP, the European Union GDP, and approximately 4% of the population. So in this sense, it's a small problem, but we need a big solution. We need a big solution for the small problems. In this particular case, I think that big solutions to small problems, if we can say that both the Balkans are far from being small problems in the history of Europe, will be entirely justified.
Thank you very much, Christoph. You have 5 minutes for your glory.
Wrapping up the conversation.
Ivan has already highlighted the very constructive role of Germany in all these past years in issues about the enlargement of Western Balkans, and I hope that Germany will continue with this role. So,
I think so. Indeed, we have always been supportive of the enlargement process in the Western Balkans, and now we are also supportive of the enlargement process that is starting with Ukraine, Moldova, and the potential candidacy of Georgia. I think that the enlargement world always oscillates between a geopolitical view on enlargement and an internal European view on enlargement. And I think clearly we're now in the geopolitical point of time. And I think this is beneficial for the enlargement process, not only in Ukraine, but also on the Western Balkans. At the same time, I would like to stress that the internal part of the internal point of view is also very important, because the European Union in the end is not any kind of international forum where you just join and then you're part of it, but it's basically a transformation of the public order of the countries who join the European Union. And of course, the European Union has to be prepared for that, but also the countries who join have to be prepared for that. I think the other way around, the Brexit, is a very good point in case where you can see how much entangled countries are when they join the European Union. So the process is, that's why I think the process is not always that easy as one would like. And this is independently from the question of the political will, that is also sometimes a problem.
Thank you very much. We can talk about Europe, Ukraine, the Western Balkans and so on much more time, but this first round table is over. Next one will be dedicated completely to the Ukrainian war. I invited you to attend it. Thank you very much, Christoph, Javier, Ivan, and they deserve applause, I think, at least. Much more than it.
Fundación FAES en podcast.